All right, we are plugged in and ready to rock and roll. You're listening to the Crazz Files podcast with Adam, and it's a Wednesday night here in Sydney, Australia. So great to be on board with everybody out there. Hope everyone's doing fine as well. Tracy Northern is plugging in with me tonight again for a very special show indeed. And she's going to cover all her years of amazing research into germ and virus theory. So this is going to be a good one tonight, and Tracy's going to be going over all of this for our listeners. So don't worry about me. I'm going to be still plugged in and just taking notes and learning a lot myself. It's such an incredibly important subject, you know, because the whole world is they're just spooked at the moment because of this boogeyman COVID-19 virus, and it really is insane. I've just had enough, and we need to get this on the table, this research. And the last show we did was has been very successful, and it's getting great feedback from all over the world. So really cool to get that. Everything's up on my website, crazzfiles.com. contact me through there. All the social media feeds are through the website now. A lot of new ones going up, so check those out and contact me. And also thanks to my members for your support, and can't do it without you guys. And support me over on crazzfiles.com. Tracy, we continue on this podcast this week, and thanks so much for your time. And I know you've put so much effort into this. This is a not an easy thing to research, and it's as you were saying before we started, people can't get their heads around this, you're going to be talking about tonight. It's just this hold that the pharmaceutical and medical system has over people and their lives, and it's all done through fear. And it's we really need to get this information out to people and get the discussion rolling. So I thought it would be great for you to plug in with me tonight and cover all your research in the way that you would like to do and have the time to do it, and just relaxed and go through all these bullet points. And you've been working on this all week, so great to have you on here. I would say, Tracy, just start off wherever you would like to, and don't worry about me. As I said, I'm here in the background on mute to give you the best sound quality as I can, and just take it where you would like to. And thanks again so much for doing this for us and all our listeners out there. We much appreciate it, and your time.
Oh, you're very welcome, and good morning. It's actually morning here, so I wanted to find out and go through how we got ourselves into this pickle that we're in right now. Talk about the main ingredient. What's the main ingredient? The heart that's pumping the fear around the world right now. It's the germ theory. Without it, they would never have been able to build up the fear to the hysterical level it's reached. They'd never have been able to build the all-encompassing and powerful Big Pharma. And they would never have had so much power to wield over the entire earth. This is why it's so important that we understand what germ theory is and what it's not. So what is the germ theory? Let's look in the dictionary. The Britannica definition says, germ theory, the theory that certain diseases are caused by the invasion of the body by microorganisms. Organisms too small to be seen except through a microscope. And then Merriam-Webster's definition, a theory, where's it gone? My computer's messing up. Merriam-Webster's definition, a theory in medicine, infections, contagious diseases, and various other conditions result from the action of microorganisms. That's it, very short. One thing the medical establishment always throws at us is their favourite quote, correlation does not equal causation, which means basically just because something's there, it doesn't mean it's the cause. And they use this to poo-poo any claims that their drugs might be making us sick. Yet they totally ignore it when it comes to germ theory. In fact, germ theory only works if you break the rule and blame the first thing you see. Just like the old analogy of blaming the firemen for the fire they come to put out, or blaming the flies for the garbage. some people might be surprised to know that germ theory and all that's been built on it is only less than 150 years old officially. And just like the information war going on today with censorship, the story of how germ theory gains so much ground is also heavily censored. No one in medical school or even any school is ever taught about a scientist called Bechamp, who in his day was more important than Einstein. He was infinitely cleverer and years ahead of the man who everyone does talk about, Mr. Pasteur. Yeah, Pasteur was a fame and power-hungry showman with a big mouth and a bad temper. He was also extremely cruel, to the point even his contemporaries complained about him sawing the skulls off live dogs and even using condemned prisoners for vivisecting. That's doing live experiments on people and animals. He was not well liked and certainly not a great scientist. So we wonder, how did he and his theory get so famous? There's no written proof of it, but all the signs point to outside influence and help. Strings were definitely pulled and connections made. He was either introduced into the club or was one of their puppets, used because of his showmanship to usher in their control mechanism, which was to be the germ theory, the bogeyman, the invisible enemy, also the perfect weapon, as well as a scapegoat for all the growing industries which were truly hurting people, their industries. It's well known that the Rothschilds were strongly linked with European royalty and Napoleon at the time, influencing everything from wars to education. So no doubt they had a hand in the rise of Pasteur and his germ theory, which also explains the quick take-up of the cause in America by the Rockefellers and other countries where the families held power. So anything you read about Pasteur's experiments, which were put on like large shows to crowds of people, is usually fake news or censored, like his anthrax experiments on sheep. We are told they were a raging success, and his anthrax vaccine did make him a large fortune. A few years ago, though, in 1971, his journals, which had been passed down with the condition that they were to be kept secret, were in fact made public as the last male heir had died. And those journals were a bombshell to the germ theory. They exposed the way he cheated, he lied, and he plagiarised fellow scientists, especially Bechamp. Remember those sheep? In his first experiment, he vaccinated 4,564 sheep, of which 3,696 dropped dead almost instantly. He had to pay for all the sheep he'd killed. So for his next public experiment, he just cheated. So basically, Pasteur was the original poster child for a marketing campaign for the pharmaceutical company's ultimate brainchild, the vaccine. The foundation was set there. Vaccines were to be the basis of the new health system based entirely on the unproven germ theory. So what about this Bechamp fella, and why was he so ignored? Well, because his work was proving the complete opposite of what Pasteur was selling so hard. Germs were not the cause of disease. While Pasteur was busy hobnobbing with Napoleon and partying with his mates and doing his showcase experiments, Bechamp was quietly beavering away in his lab, looking at the germs under the newly invented microscope. He saw that the microbes were not, in fact, all different species. He saw them change from one form into another, like caterpillars into butterflies, or like seeds into plants. Except they didn't only change once or twice. They had many forms. They seemed to start as a seed or a spore. This was the tiniest form, which he called a microzyma. And then they went through a number of different shapes, from a TB shape, which is a rod shape. He saw a Y shape, which they now claim is an antibody. and he saw various other shapes that Pasteur claimed to be different species, until the final form, which bursts forth more of the spores, so it goes back to the beginning. This is called pleomorphism, and this one discovery should have put the germ theory to bed right there and then, because how can they blame a specific species of a microbe as being a cause of a specific disease if it's not a specific species, but just one face of the same microbe? It didn't kill the germ theory, though, because it was ignored, buried, and censored. And nowadays, pleomorphism gets referred to as good and bad bacteria. So Bichamp also discovered that the germs didn't invade from outside, but they were already in the body and produced in and by the body. He also showed that the morphing into different forms happened when the tissue they were in was dead or dying, or if poisons were introduced. He observed them morphing and cleaning up dead tissues and cells, and even neutralizing some poisons. The germs were not causing anything. They were cleaning up the mess caused by something else. They are like the cleanup crew after a bomb blast. And in some cases, they have to don hazmat suits in order to get the job done. This is why they morph, to protect themselves from the hazards they're cleaning up and to survive hostile terrains. Robert Koch was around at the same time, and he came into the fray with his contribution, which was to set up scientific rules which would verify this germ theory. These rules are called Koch's postulates. One big problem with that was that however hard they tried, they could not even make the first rule stick. So they were looking at tuberculin, the rod-shaped bacteria they thought was causing TB. And they couldn't find it in every person who showed the symptoms. They also did find it in perfectly healthy people with no symptoms. So now you see why it's still, after all this time, called a theory and not a law. It has never fulfilled any of the laws set up to prove it. This is why we get convoluted explanations to explain themselves out of this fact. It's called circular reasoning and the art of bullshitting. Meantime, across the pond in America, Rockefeller and his club, no doubt under the direction of the Rothschilds, were quickly setting up their modern medical empire on the foundation of this germ theory, which was being mirrored all over the countries the Rothschilds had power and influence in. Using philanthropy as their cover, they were effectively buying up all the universities and closing down all the herbalists and the homeopathic schools and hospitals, because they were far too successful at helping people get well very cheaply using natural substances which couldn't be patented and so controlled and profited from by the now powerful pharma companies, which were also being bought up by Rockefeller, who'd seen the opportunity to make new drugs from ingredients from his oil refining business. Follow the money. You can read all about this process in detail in a book called The Medicine Racket. It's online. It's quite easy to find. There's also a film called Rockefeller Medicine, which amazingly is still on YouTube. Modern orthodox medicine is a racket and was built using mafia tactics, which is the workings behind philanthropy. Notice how much power Bill Gates' philanthropic donations has bought him today. Same process being used again to gain power and wealth. During that time, back in the early 1900s, there were also many experiments being carried out to find the actual mode of contagion in the germ theory, to find out how were these diseases being passed from one person to another. I've got all these studies in one article on my WordPress called Contagion, A Fairy Story. I won't read them all out for the sake of time and boring you all, but here's a snippet of one of the experiments I've picked out because of the interesting conclusion they stumbled on, because it's quite relevant to our situation. In 1930, Dochet et al., that's Dochet and his crew, attempted to infect a group of men experimentally with the common cold. The authors stated in their results something that is nothing short of amazing. It was apparent very early that this individual was more or less unreliable, and from the start it was possible to keep him in the dark regarding our procedure. He had inconspicuous symptoms after his test injection of sterile broth, and no more striking results from the cold filtrate, until an assistant on the second day after injection inadvertently referred to this failure to contract a cold. That evening and night, the subject reported severe symptomatology, including sneezing, cough, sore throat, and stuffiness in the nose. The next morning, he was told that he had been misinformed in regard to the the nature of the filtrate, and his symptoms subsided within the hour. It's important to note that there was an entire absence of objective pathological changes. In other words, they couldn't see anything going on under the microscope. So it seemed in this case they'd found people could be made sick by mere suggestion. Interesting, don't you think? All the other experiments completely failed to make people sick unless they were injected or had it shoved right up their noses, as in this next experiment. In 1920, Schmidt et al. Conducted two controlled experiments, exposing healthy people to the bodily fluids of sick people. Of 196 people exposed to the mucus secretions of sick people, 21 developed colds and 3 developed gripper, which is flu. In the second group of the 84 healthy people exposed to mucus secretions of sick people, 5 developed gripper and 4 colds. Of 43 controls who had been inoculated with sterile physiological salt solutions, 8 developed colds. And that's an 18.6% rise, as opposed to the highest in the other groups was 5.9%. A higher percentage of people got sick after being exposed to saline compared to those being exposed to the virus, in inverted commas. I wonder if the word virus is being used in the old sense or the new here. I don't know. So the placebo group were the worst affected. Of all the various experiments, not one person became sick from personal contact, even to the point of swapping spit. Then there's the curious case of Masher and Dasher in the 1950s. A new mother was told that her twin babies had died after birth. However, the truth was far different. They were sent to an institute near Moscow to be studied. This was to be the fate of Masha and Dasha, one of the most unusual sets of Siamese or conjoined twins ever born. Because their circulatory systems are interconnected, the twins share each other's blood. Therefore, a bacterium or virus that enters one twin's bloodstream will soon be seen in the blood of her sister. Yet surprisingly, illness affects them differently. Dasha is short-sighted, prone to colds, and right-handed. Masha smokes occasionally, has a healthier constitution, higher blood pressure than her sister, good eyesight, and is left-handed. The twins' differing health patterns present a mystery. Why did one become ill with a childhood disease, like measles, for example, while the other did not? The measles bug was in both of their bodies, in their collective bloodstream. So why didn't both get the measles? Evidently, there's more to getting the measles than having the measles bug. This phenomenon was seen over and over again with the girls. Flu, colds, and other childhood diseases were all experienced separately. If germs alone had the power to cause infectious diseases, Why would one of the twins be disease-free while the other was ill? Interesting. A man called Royal Raymond Rife also came along in the 1930s and invented a new microscope, which miraculously could see live microbes down to much smaller sizes, which could potentially blow their cover again. He could see the tiniest microbes, which we now know are the microzyma. There are other names for it by other scientists. Some call them protists, some call them somatids. His life's work and his microscope were seized by the FBI, never to be seen again. And poor Rife was driven to drink and his reputation also destroyed. And he wasn't even anti-germ theory. He was, however, a threat to the drugs business. Why did the medical industry not want to use this amazing new technology, but plumped for the electron microscope instead, which can only see dead tissues, nothing living, nothing moving? I think we know. I'll just mention in passing that more recently, a man in Canada called Gaston Nesons has also built a similar microscope and is actually videoing pleomorphism. And he's even mapped out all the different forms they take. But that's something you can look into yourself. So this exposing of the germ theory as false had to be nipped in the bud. So what did they do? They invented viruses. They had to be smaller than the wavelength of light, so no one could see them under a normal microscope. So the invisible enemy was reborn, and a new business could also be built on it, called virology. It was also in the 1930s, coincidentally, that the dictionary definition of virus was changed by Rockefeller, Rivers and Flexner from the old definition of a liquid poison to this new one. Any of various submicroscopic agents that infect living organisms, often causing disease, and that consist of a single or double strand of RNA or DNA surrounded by a protein coat. Unable to replicate without a host cell, viruses are typically not considered living organisms. Not living. Then they're not a microbe. And also, what's all that nonsense about living viruses and live virus vaccines? There's more circular reasoning there going on. So virology is the ultimate pseudoscience. It's built on the crumbling foundations of germ theory and sellotaped together with the newly developed science of genetics. It's the business of chasing unicorns, things that don't exist and that no one can refute without having journeyed into the belly of the beast and seen the cogs in the machine making the fantasy sci-fi production called The Virus Hunters. That's if it were a Hollywood production, which it kind of is. Stefan Lanka did exactly that. He went backstage and he saw all the actors without their makeup and he knew it was all a massive con trick. There are no viruses, there never were. They've even taken the pleomorphism, which is starting to creep out of oblivion, and slapped it onto their story about viruses. Why do their vaccines not work? Oh, because the virus is morphed and mutated, they like to say. But it's the very thing which could have brought down the original germ theory. And they've managed to prop up germ theory Mark II with it. It's like a magic trick, but not a very good one. It's also a slap in the face to poor old Bechamp. They're mocking us. Everyone who's arguing over details, like ingredients, safety, efficacy of different vaccines or drugs, is either still ignorant or has one foot in and one foot out of this business. Especially when we know they've been shown the proof that germ theory is a lie and viruses don't exist. There are many people out there who are controlling the narrative, hiding details from us still. These are called gatekeepers and controlled opposition. They're easy to spot once you know everything I've told you here. like those in the anti-vaccine movement who shout that they're not anti-vax and that they want safer vaccines. That's controlled opposition. If they really wanted to end dangerous vaccines, they'd tell the truth that they never worked and never will. But hey, that would be too easy, and they'd have to go and get a proper job. There are those who harp on about bad bacteria and healthy microbiomes. There are no good and bad bacteria. There are only bacteria in various forms affected by the environment that they're in. This refers to Bichamp's terrain theory. Bacteria are just seen in varying forms, like people wearing protective gear. Even fungus is one of these forms, and it's the one needed for the most toxic cleanups. Just like fungus can be used to clean up giant oil spills in the sea, or how fungi clear up the dead stuff on the forest floor where there's no light. When they speak of an infection, they're referring to a clean-up site where lots of bacteria are working hard to sort out some mess. For example, if you get a splinter in your finger and try hard as you can, you can't get it out, what happens? A blister forms. It'll be sore because it's inflamed. That's the extra blood transporting things in and out of the site. A white bubble will form around the splinter. This is full of microbes trying to break the splinter down. If it can't be broken down, then the skin will grow under it and eventually the body pushes out the splinter. I've seen this happen on my own fingers. This is your so-called immune system. There is no such thing as an immune system, though, because there's nothing to be immune to. And the things they call diseases can happen more than once. The immune theory was built on the findings of the ability to become drug resistant. Say if you take a drug regularly in small doses, your body becomes accustomed. And to get the effect that the drug produces, you need to take more and more. Like you become immune to the poisons. This is the body learning how to deal with a specific toxin more efficiently and is a well-known process. They've just tagged it onto the germ theory and applied it to germs. But as we know, germs do not cause disease, so it does not apply and you cannot be immune from being poisoned again. You do not strengthen your immune system, as the naturopaths like to say. You just stop poisoning yourself. And you give your body good, clean, species-appropriate food. What we've been taught is an immune system is actually a garbage collection system and a hazardous waste disposal system. So if there is no immune system and we do not build up immunity to germs, our own clean-up crew, they are. You can't build up immunity to your own clean-up crew. Then vaccines are a complete and utter scam. So why do you think they have to put adjuvants into vaccines? To make the fictitious immune system react to the injection of some germs. Adjuvants in English are toxic ingredients like heavy metals. One of them is the favourite of the orthodox quacks of old, mercury. They actually used to give it out like sweets back in the day. For all manner of illness, along with cocaine and heroin, three very popular medicines. No wonder everyone was scared of the quacks. By the way, the name quack comes from the German for mercury, which is Quackensilber. It's funny how they now call naturopaths or anyone using a different method a quack, just like projecting or mirroring that those Satanists use. Just saying. They've been hiding mercury in vaccines for years. So when they give a vaccine, the body is not reacting to the germs. It's reacting to a massive toxic explosion entering the body from a direction that's the most difficult to deal with, right into the tissues and the bloodstream, so bypassing our natural defense barriers, the skin, the mucous membranes, the digestive system. Provaxers also like to say about this deadly poison in vaccines that the poison is in the dose, basically meaning a tiny dose of poison is not necessarily poisonous. But it was proven in the early 1900s that the mode of entry of poison can change all that. Look up Richet, spelled R-I-C-H-E-T, and his Nobel Prize winning talk on anaphylaxis, which never existed before vaccines. They've known since back then that injection of anything, especially proteins, alarmingly, can induce the body to have a severe reaction if it encounters the same substance a second time, like in a minuscule dose. Now, thinking about how they give vaccines one after the other and that they're not injecting viruses but proteins, remember the description of a virus, they also put common foodstuffs in there, like peanut oil. Do you think that might cause some serious problems? And how have they ignored this Nobel Prize winning work all these years? Odd, isn't it? Do they know or not? It's obviously not in the script. It's another inconvenient truth. So if you're listening to doctors or mainstream scientists for your info, you're still watching The Muppet Show, directed and produced by Rockefeller Medicine. They'll reel you in with their pretty CGI pictures and qualifications, and they'll bamboozle you with fancy long Latin words and circular reasoning. They like to tell people like me and you, dear listener, that we are stupid because we're not qualified, so we can't possibly understand science. A nurse actually said this to me the other day. These people have been thoroughly indoctrinated into the cult and don't know how to tell the truth without admitting their whole career has been a lie and that they've been killing people, not healing them. They call doctors officially the third leading cause of death, but they're only third officially because they claim cancer and heart disease kill slightly more people. But there again, those deaths were also from the treatments meted out by doctors and not their own body's healing processes. So medical doctors are in fact the number one cause of death today. That's a hard pill to swallow. So you can see why they'd prefer not to go there. The only doctors and scientists worth listening to are the ones who are retired or got out when they found out the truth. Even naturopaths and many so-called alternative medicine doctors are steeped in germ theory and all its trappings. The truth is, ultimately, our bodies are miraculous, self-healing organisms. The body does not need help to heal except in extreme circumstances of injury, which is life-threatening. In fact, when you think you are sick or diseased, as you're having symptoms, those are the actual signs of the body healing itself and your microbiome doing its thing. Pushing out poisons through the skin is an obvious process we can see happening with things like chickenpox, or indeed anything called a pox. Even acne is the same process of cleansing. Lots of different names for all the same thing. All the symptoms we see, which they call disease, are in fact the body healing itself from something. And guess who's doing all the hard work in there? Yep, those germs. Those acute illnesses, which they claim to be contagious diseases, if you notice, they're all explosions of toxins exiting the body through the skin, the mouth, the lungs, the bowels, just about every hole we have. When doctors interfere with their drugs, which stop all these processes, they're effectively closing all the exits and forcing the body to deal with it somehow in another way. This is where chronic illness comes in. Those toxins have to be dealt with somehow, so temporarily they can be stored in the fat, which keeps them out of reach of the organs. if they're too toxic for that, they can be cordoned off into what we know as tumours or cysts. The body then has to deal with the new toxins, which have been added to the mix by the doctor, by the administered drugs. It's a kind of prioritising in the body. Lock the first offenders up temporarily and go deal with the new assault. The drugs actually put the body in stress mode, fight or flight mode, which is why we seem to feel better when we take the drugs. We tend to feel energised when we're under stress. It hasn't, however, cured anything. The build-up of toxic load will have to be dealt with by the body sometime down the line, when the body comes out of stress mode, which is usually when we're on holiday. And the bigger the load, the bigger and more dramatic the symptoms will be. It's like an accident waiting to happen, except it's no accident. There's so much to learn about what we're only now being shown, thanks to the internet and those pesky conspiracy nuts. It may seem overwhelming, but it isn't, because it's so much simpler than a convoluted theory propped up by circular reasoning and blatant lies. The truth is always simpler than lies. The truth has always been here, written and spoken about by people practicing what they call alternatives, but that are really just the truth. I'd especially recommend you look into natural hygiene, which is not what you may think from the name. When you hear hygiene nowadays, you might automatically think of killing germs, right? That's not what the word actually means. Look it up, be amazed to see how they've twisted things. It's no good looking to science for proof, as that's all controlled within the system built on germ theory and controlled by the club. Unless you learn their language and how to read their studies and spot the gaping mistakes. And that can take years of practice and study and needs confidence and conviction. I'd like to end with a couple of quotes from What Really Makes You Ill by Dawn Lester and Dave Parker, which sum things up nicely, I think. It's a fundamental principle that the burden of proof lies with those who propose a theory. Yet in the case of germ theory, that proof does not exist. There is no original scientific evidence that definitively proves that any germ causes any specific disease. There are, however, many reasons for the germ theory to be perpetuated as if it has been scientifically established and proven to be true. Some of those reasons relate to economics, politics, and geopolitics. It's all about the money and power. I just want to open your eyes a little and hope you'll go and look into what I've said here. And I'll give a list of reading material if you want to look at more details. It's so important to wrench ourselves out of this sick, twisted paradigm they've built all around us before it kills us all. I sometimes feel tipping point is near, and other days I feel despair that we're never going to get it. I also suspect that they know the game's up and the cash cow is almost dead on its feet, and this might just be the final death throes of the dying paradigm. Or is it just their genocidal plan of depopulation finally playing out? They've hinted all along that the health industry is to change. What that change brings, though, is up to us. We have to base it on truth, not profits. We have to also lose the fear and trust our own bodies. We're perfectly designed, as is all nature. Germ theory is not natural. It doesn't follow any of the rules of nature. It's a man-made dogma within a cult. Mother Nature, or God, if you believe in him, didn't make any mistakes. We did.